Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hi, I'm Gideon Long, and on Business Daily, we're looking at shipwrecks. We'll dive into the dispute over the Spanish galleon, the San Jose, which sank off the coast of Colombia 300 years ago with billions of dollars worth of booty on board. And we asked businessman Carl Allen why he became a shipwreck hunter. Join us on Business Daily from the BBC World Service every weekday to hear more about the daily drama of money and work. Search for Business Daily wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Mubin Azhar, and welcome to this bonus episode in the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm one of the hosts of the BBC's Lives Less Ordinary podcast, delivering extraordinary stories from around the world. We'll bring you an episode of Lives Less Ordinary here from time to time, but to hear every episode, search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you find your BBC podcasts.
When you are here with a heavy sentence on you, it is as if you have died, but you are not completely detached from this world.
This is the voice of Anousheh Ashoori, speaking from inside prison in Iran. He's been jailed for espionage, charges that were unfounded and untrue.
This place is sometimes called the land of the living dead, with many walking aimlessly back and forth, day after day, month after month, and year after year, continuously asking themselves, what have I done to deserve this?
He's not sure how long he'll be locked up, but hope keeps him alive. That same hope also makes him vulnerable to disappointment and the crushing lows that come with it. He finds ways to cope: art, poetry, and the rich intellect of fellow prisoners. But every year that passes is another year spent apart from the family he loves so dearly.
I only live with the memories of my wife, my kids. By the time I am out of this circle of hands, after 10 years, I may be too old for them to recognize me when we pass by each other, if we are not told that we are related.
This is the Lives Less Ordinary podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Mubin Azhar, and today, the story of Anousheh, a man who found himself a pawn at the centre of global politics. Thankfully, Anousheh is back in London now, and he joined me in person in the Outlook studio.
Shall I just sit here, maybe?
To know Anousheh, you've got to understand his passions. So we started with his first love, science fiction. We're talking Flash Gordon and Star Trek.
Your imagination is stretched to unbelievable limits with the stories that Star Trek has in each episode. I mean, that was part of the love for space that I started having.
And is it true, as a boy in Tehran, when you were watching Flash Gordon, Star Trek, did that inspire a kind of wanderlust and a desire to go into space?
Very much so. That became my dream. So when I was at high school, on the ceiling of my study, I started building a solar system, and I had pictures of both astronauts and cosmonauts on the wall of my study. And those who were killed, there was this black band.
Oh, no. Yeah. Okay.
And, then I started building a rocket. Well, that has got a long story to it. I don't think we can.
Yeah, go for it. Well, tell me about the rocket.
When I was around 16, my father had he won a contract to do the water systems in a city near the Caspian Sea called Kelardasht. And they needed a lot of dynamite and gunpowder. So I went to this flue maker locally, and I asked him to make a cylinder for me. And I made this rocket. So one weekend when we had gone to a picnic, I went a little further than where my parents were with my brother and a friend. And we set it up and we lit the wick and we lit it and we ran away. Unfortunately, it exploded.
It never made it into space.
No.
At least there was the aspiration. You know, a lot of people who, and I say this from friends that love sci-fi, there is this kind of reimagining of an alternative world. And, you know, the themes are always the same, aren't they, in Star Trek and Flash Gordon. It's good versus evil. But you can imagine this kind of world beyond our own. When you were watching this stuff when you were very young, this was pre-revolution, wasn't it?
Yes.
In Iran. So what was your life like? Was there any sense of you wanting to be in another place? Or was it actually a lovely childhood?
I was raised quite comfortably. We are not stinking rich, but we were living a very comfortable life.
Was there a sense of it being open?
Yes.
You know, could you do what you wanted to do?
The only prohibition was activities against the regime.
Mm-hmm.
If you were not involved in that, then it was complete freedom for you to do whatever you wanted to do. I joined a model aircraft society, which was set up by the Iranian National Aviation.
That charmed childhood passed, and Anousheh eventually moved to the UK in 1972 to study mechanical engineering. He really took to life in London and met someone he was interested in too. She was called Sherry, and she was also from Iran.
We were not serious at all. She was just my friend's sister. But when I went to Cranfield to do aeronautical engineering, I was invited to their house because her mom was living with her. She used to buy tickets, and I used to come to London to stay over the weekend, and we used to go and watch these plays and operas. So gradually this feeling started between us.
When you went to see the ballet, for example, did you know that was a date, or was it just two friends going along?
It was so subtle. I cannot pinpoint a certain flash, for example, that it suddenly happened. It was very gradual and very romantic in a way. So, it just built up.
It built up?
Yes.
Did you have a clear sense of her being the one, or did it take a long time to work out that she was the woman that you want to spend the rest of your life with?
That's a very interesting question, because character-wise, we are so different. In fact, in some ways, we are so opposite to each other. And we think that that is one of the reasons. It's like a jigsaw puzzle. Where all the protrusions it just fitted.
Mm-hmm.
With when she was talking about, for example, English writers. And when I used to talk about engineering and about space, we somehow were so interested to listen to the other one. We fitted somehow.
While Anousheh and Sherry were falling in love and starting a life together, Iran was changing. In 1979, the Shah's regime was overthrown and it was replaced with the Islamic Republic. For a while, Anousheh and Sherry did move back and forth, but they found it difficult to adapt to the restrictions of post-revolution Iran.
We could not conform. That ideology was just out of the question. So we formed this bubble. So I was in my workspace, and when I used to come home, we had this circle of friends who most of them were had studied in Britain or the States, and we were almost of the same wavelength. So if we invited each other at different places, those places had become the hangout places. It concentrated, all these activities concentrated in our houses rather than outside, because outside you were restricted, they had to wear this hijab, whereas in our circles we were free, we could dance, we could do so many things that you couldn't do outside. So
you could do almost exactly what you want, but it had to be behind closed doors.
Yes. I was torn between the two cultures. There were things that I liked in Iran, but there were so many things that I loved in Britain that I was deprived of. So this bewilderness existed for quite a long time. So we somehow felt that we belong more to Britain, to this culture.
They bought a home in Southeast London, and it's there that they schooled their children, worked, and eventually retired. It was a nice life. As I said before, Anuche is a man with many hobbies and passions, so retirement was something to relish. He'd spent days tinkering in his workshop and inventing things, like a machine to make macaroons, the light and often sticky sweets, for his daughter, who'd started a bakery business. And then there was another project out in the garden.
Sherry had fallen in love from the very beginning with Lord of the Rings. She started even buying bespoke bits and pieces from New Zealand. They used to arrive.
All the merchandise.
Yeah, and what I decided to do, because our garden was rather large, so I decided to create a hobbit house for her. So that hobbit house was actually the middle of its construction, and its circular door was sewn and placed. And
in your garden?
Yes, and it was a replica of a hill, which I was going to grow shrubs on top of it, so that it would look like a hill with this cavey thing. And
it sounds
so
special.
So this hobbit house and that macaron machine were in the middle of making when I went back to Iran.
Anuche would visit his mother in Tehran a few times a year. And this trip began completely normally. Family, food and friends.
It was perhaps 10 days that I was in Iran. And I was even invited to a relative's child's birthday. When I arrived in Iran, when I was going to show the contents of my suitcase to the person at the customs, its zipper didn't work. It broke. So I somehow managed to put it in the taxi and I went back home. But I didn't want to buy another suitcase because this was a very good one. So I decided, because there was this person in a local market who was very good in repairing suitcases. So I thought to myself, I better take it there and do some souvenir shopping as well. So when I got out, I reached the foot of the hill with this empty suitcase in my hand, where this car pulled over and four very huge men came outside. And one of them asked my name. And when they made sure that it was me, the other one grabbed the suitcase from me and said, "What is in it?" And I said, "Nothing, it's empty." And as he was opening it, and he had the difficulty actually opening it because the zipper didn't work properly, mm-hmm. but it was quite light. The other one manhandled me into the back seat of the car. And passers-by were actually standing watching what was going on. I was in shock. I didn't know what was happening. And quickly I found myself in the motorway. And as we were driving towards the east of Tehran, the guy in the front next to the driver turned around and showed me a piece of paper. As soon as I started reading it, it was my arrest warrant. And on top of that, it was written the anti-espionage department of something. I was so shocked.
You'd been arrested. Did they actually tell you why? Were you charged with anything?
They just showed me the piece of paper. They didn't even let me finish it. I just saw the title. And he grabbed it from me. And from the back of his seat, there was this pocket behind his seat. They grabbed a blindfold and they told me to put it on my eyes. And I had to lean on the lap of the person to my left. And I was told to remain like that until I am told. I could hear the traffic. And later on, the sound of traffic diminished. And I felt that we are going inside the driveway of a house because I could hear this metal door opening and closing. And I was blindfolded. I was guided. I was ushered into this house. From underneath my blindfold, I could see this Persian carpet. It was completely quiet. So they took me through this hallway to this room. They closed the door. They made me sit on this chair. And then they told me I could take my blindfold off. So I took my blindfold. And then there were three people. And my interrogation started from there.
What were you asked?
They did not ask any particular thing. What they said is just talk about your life. Talk about anybody you know. And I was saying, well, give me a clue. I mean, what are you talking about? Is it about my business? And he said, okay, talk about your business. I was saying, is it about my family? Oh, no, talk about your family. So even now, I think my interrogator, he really didn't know what was going on. He was ordered to interrogate me. At one point in time, as he was quite emotional, because he couldn't get anything from me, and perhaps he was under pressure, and it wasn't paying off. And he said to me, yes, I know, good, good, no good. So that was the amount of English knowledge that he had.
When did it become apparent to you that even if you played ball, even if you sat in that room and answered their questions, that you weren't going home?
Well, he told me, you are going to be here, and I have the authority to keep you here for 2 years. And then I can get the consent of the judge to have you for another 2 years, and then for another 2 years, unless you say whatever you know. And I said, okay, I don't mind. Let me write down whatever I know. And whatever I used to write, he used to tear the paper and say, well, this is not what I want. And then he started connecting me to a few bombings in the past.
When you say connecting you, how so?
For example, he said there were these bombings of this nuclear scientist. We had heard about it, but we didn't know. I mean, that was just the news and we just ignored it. And I said, well, I don't know. He said, who is your officer? Who is your Israeli officer? And I said, believe me, these are just what you are thinking. It's not. They didn't listen. You had no hope for the future, because in the interrogation center, they try to break you so that you lose all hope. So when you are completely write off, then you are being sent. You are sent to the prison itself to wait for your trial, to wait for your destiny.
Is the idea to get you to admit to something that you haven't done?
They are not. They are, in fact, incompetence is one of their traits. Their characters. It's much easier to arrest somebody and to create, like a sculptor, to create a spy than trying to catch one.
I know you developed quite a strange dynamic, strange relationship with your interrogators.
Well, you're in the interrogation center, in the solitary confinement. You don't have any interaction with anybody. Even the guards, they look through the people. After a while, you long for a conversation. At the beginning, you're so scared for those interrogations. But it's such a strange feeling. At the same time as you're scared, you're looking forward to it.
Looking forward
yes,
to it?
Yeah. When I hear the interrogator steps entering the room and he says hello, and I say hello, it's as if I'm trying to converse with somebody. Although it is interrogation, but you turn somehow... I don't call it affection. I don't know. It's a strange feeling. Maybe we should invent a new
special
word.
Term.
Yeah, for that.
Is it just the craving for human interaction?
Maybe that. Maybe you could hear news from your family, because he used to tell me that I know right now in your front door neighbor is doing their roof, and it was a lie. Or we have sent people to Grange Market, and they have tasted your daughter's macarons, and they liked the pistachio flavor. Later on, when I came back, I discovered that it was all lie. But then I could hear something, some news, even it's in those conditions. So a combination of all of these things would make you feel looking forward to that interaction, because it was only you and that person.
I get it, even though it wasn't true, just the suggestion that the neighbor's house is having the roof fixed, or that your daughter's been making pistachio macaroons, it just allows you to imagine that life is continuing.
Yes.
And I guess within that, there's some hope, isn't there? Because you can imagine that perhaps one day I'm going to be back at home. I'm going to see the family.
Unfortunately, when with the interrogator saying that, he didn't intend to create hope in me, because then he would tell me that, look, they are under our thumb. If you don't cooperate, you won't see them again. They would break you with using that as a tool to tell you that, look, next time I might come with a picture, with a photograph of the corpse.
It's terrifying.
So then you are caught between two conflicting thoughts. And that is what drove me to the point that I decided not to exist.
In fact, Anousheh made several attempts to end his life. He also went on hunger strike.
In fact, when they realized that I was not eating was when I was 2 days a week, we were allowed to have a shower. They could see how thin I had become. So weak and so thin.
Eventually, he was taken from solitary confinement and sent to a communal cell in the main part of Evin prison. You may have heard of this place before. Built by the Shah on the edge of Tehran, it had wings for criminals and political prisoners, and also included a yard for executions. During the revolution, it was stormed and prisoners were freed by the rebels. But before long, under the Islamic Republic, a new generation of political prisoners were being locked up. Conditions were notorious, but because it housed so many students and intellectuals, it became known as Evin University. Now, fresh out of solitary confinement, Anousheh was sent to Hall 12, designated for political and international prisoners like him. His new cellmates had some of the most educated minds in Iran.
When I entered, I saw people exactly in the same shoes as I was. So most of them were highly educated. Then you see that you're not alone. They have gone through it before you, and now it is your turn to go through it.
Mm-hmm.
There comes a time, because you have to associate with people, especially after coming out of a solitary confinement, you want to interact with people. And it ended up with me having certain friends, for example, this friend who came to me, and inmate, it wasn't a friend at that time, came to me and started reciting a poem from a Persian poet, Sohrab Sepehri. And I liked it very much. And I said, well, can you repeat and recite another one? And he did. And as he was doing it, two other inmates joined. And they
turned into a poetry recital.
Yes. And when it finished, it perhaps was an hour. Then I suggested that, why don't we do it again? So we did that. We repeated that. This time, a couple more had joined. Then I said to this person, why not make a society, a poet society?
If you're feeling gripped by this episode and would like to hear more incredible life stories from around the world, remember to search Lives Less Ordinary wherever you found this podcast.
Hi, I'm Gideon Long, and on Business Daily, we're looking at shipwrecks. We'll dive into the dispute over the Spanish galleon, the San Jose, which sank off the coast of Colombia 300 years ago with billions of dollars worth of booty on board. And we asked businessman Carl Allen why he became a shipwreck hunter. Join us on Business Daily from the BBC World Service every weekday to hear more about the daily drama of money and work. Search for Business Daily wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
From the BBC World Service, I'm Mubin Azhar with the story of Anousheh Ashoori, who's finding ways to cope with life in Evin prison.
Then I discovered so many talented poets. And from the heart of that poetry society, because we had this inmate who had a 19-year sentence on him, he was a satirist, a very humorous person, and he had written books. And he said, I can teach you how to do short stories. So we started forming another society, which was called Short Story Society. In that short story society, he used to give us homeworks to pick up a subject. And one of these subjects was, what is your dream? And I said, my dream is running the London Marathon. And then he said, okay, everybody should write about running the London Marathon. So for the next session, we had to write something about running the London Marathon. I have still kept mine.
As well as companionship inside prison, he was allowed a bit of phone contact with his wife, Sherry, back in London.
Any time I was going to talk to Sherry, this lump would bulge out in my throat and it just stopped me from talking. It didn't happen to me only. It happened to many of the inmates. And you could just see tears running down. It was so difficult.
We have recordings of some of these calls because Sherry was taping them. But the prison authorities were taping them too. And Anousheh knew they were being listened to. Intimacy was difficult. So as you'll hear, the conversations sometimes take on a poetic code. This conversation was in Farsi.
ما الان آره. به هیچ وجه نمیتونیم برای 6 ماه دیگه برنامه بریم برای فردامون هم نمیتونیم
Sherry says at the moment we cannot under any circumstances make any plans for the next 6 months. We cannot even plan for our tomorrow, let alone 6 months from now.
من میدونم خودم الان به خودم چی میگم. من احساس میکنم.
Anousheh responds, do you know what I tell myself? I feel as if by accident I have fallen into a roaring river. This river is taking me with it. There's no hand grip for me to hold on to. I can't pull myself out. I must be careful so that my head will not hit a rock, so that nothing will happen to me, mentally and physically, until I arrive at the river's delta. When I arrive at the river's delta, where the water is calmer and the shore is within reach, then the way to my salvation may be found.
I used to sometimes cry and say, I miss you so much. And she used to try to control herself.
Of course.
What were you hearing about your case, about people's awareness of it? Were you aware of there being any effort to get you released?
They were organizing campaigns. Later on, Amnesty International joined in, and I was quite happy about that.
But the Iranian security forces were sticking to their story that Anousheh was in prison for espionage. He was eventually sentenced to 10 years. All the while, he began to piece together the real reason he'd been targeted. It was about international politics, and more specifically, money. Before the revolution, the Shah had paid for an order of tanks and armoured vehicles from the UK government. The tanks were never delivered, so the Iranians wanted their money back, all £400 million of it. Anousheh believes he was being used to pressure London to pay the debt, and there were others like him too. You may have heard of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, a British-Iranian woman who was also held at Evin prison in very similar circumstances. They'd been picked because of their status as dual nationals. Negotiations between the governments were taking place, but they took years. There was nothing Anousheh could really do but try to get the UK's Prime Minister on side. He did this in the best way he could, by recording a message for the British government via his prison phone line.
Dear Mr. Johnson, greetings from Evin Prison. Today is Wednesday, 10th of June, 2020, and it is now 1,033 days that I have been kept in this prison away from my family. My fear is that we have been forgotten by the British government. We are in desperate need of your help and want to return home to our loved ones before it is too late. Thank you.
Were you hopeful that you would be released, that you would see your family again?
Hopefulness is one of the things. It's like a new battery every morning that you insert it in the machine and starts working. But too much hopefulness, again, it has an adverse effect. I think they call it a toxicity of hope. Because I remember there were times that there were rumors a few people are going to be released. And I could see some around me, they were so hopeful that they started giving away their stuff. So hopeful that they were going to be released. The time would come and pass, and they were stranded. I mean, that anticlimax, it really hit them very badly.
Heartbreaking.
Yes. Yeah. So at the same time as I was hopeful that I would be released, in fact, it's a good thing that you mentioned this. There came a point that I thought to myself that, okay, there are two scenarios. One scenario is that I will be released and I will be healthy enough to lead a normal life again with my family. This is the optimistic vision. The pessimistic vision is that I will be released after 10 years, which I will be 74. I have lost my teeth. I have lost my eyesight. Even when I walk in the street and my children and my wife pass by, we won't be able to recognize each other. So I decided to divide my brain, a left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. The right hemisphere, for example, was the one which was optimistic. I could have all of these hopes. And the left hemisphere was extremely pessimistic. Hope for the best and prepare for the worst.
One way Anuche prepared for the worst was to carve out a little corner for himself in the tiny prison yard.
But then I was escaping from this 15 of us in one room. People were arguing, people were talking loudly, you didn't have any peace. There was always smell of bad breath, smell of fart. I mean, just imagine a room with 15 people in it. In this patio that we had, very narrow patio, at the end of it there was a ledge. So that was my place of refuge.
You also grew some flowers,
yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah, and so what happened was that this friend brought these seeds and said, do whatever you want to do with it. So I planted them and I didn't know what they were. As they grew up, I realized that they were ivy. So what I can do is that I can make a trellis. And I bought dental floss and I started making a trellis. But when I was sitting there...
Your mechanical engineering was coming into use.
Yeah, so it was... As it grew, I started guiding it and I started tying dental floss horizontally. So it became like a fishing net, but with very large mesh.
And did the ivy grow?
It grew and it grew and it covered all of it.
This little ivy-covered nook became a popular hangout spot for tea and discussions. It became known as Ashuri's Corner. Ashuri's Corner sounds like the most beautiful part of the prison. What was it? Is that fair?
You can see it from space. Because that patch of green thing, I'll send it to you.
It stands out.
Yes.
Anuche also got into the craft of marquetry, making 2D works of art out of inlaid pieces of wood. His subjects were his favourite scientists and Star Trek characters.
I did 3 portraits. One was Charles Darwin, David Attenborough, and the other one, Patrick Stewart.
Who plays Jean-Luc Picard.
Picard, yes. So these people who were visiting, the officials, they came, and one of them bent over. And of course, if he knew this was Charles Darwin, perhaps I would be in trouble. And then he looked at me and said, is that your father? And I said, yes.
He didn't realize it was Charles Darwin.
I mean, they are so illiterate. I mean, a bunch of nincompoops.
I know there was also a role that Star Trek played.
Sometimes I used to think of my hole as the people in the characters in the Star Trek. I somehow created a spaceship, in a sense, in my imagination.
So you just reimagined your environment.
Then I realized that, I can create things. I can imagine that I am not in a prison. Then I decided to create all these officials, from the warden, from the guards, that they are my prisoners rather than me theirs. So I imprisoned the prison within myself. And I was reasoning with myself, that one day I'm going to be released, but these prisoners are going to remain. And this is exactly what happened. I was released, but that warden, that certain guard, they are still there until they get retired and until they die.
Anuche remained optimistic enough to imagine a life after his release. Aside from a family reunion, he planned 3 things. One was to release a memoir. He began writing it in prison and reading it down the phone to Sherry so the guards couldn't destroy his words. Secondly, he planned to run the London Marathon. He began training, running back and forth in his tiny prison yard. Thirdly, he wanted to put on an exhibition, recreating the prison so people would understand what he'd experienced. He began by collecting things from around his cell and the prison yard in the hope that one day he'd smuggle them out.
I started even pigeon feathers that fell in the yard. I would gather cockroaches. I would gather bed bugs. Of course, I couldn't gather rats, but the things that I could bring with myself. I used to pay the petty thieves. I used to give them cigarette money, and I used to ask them that if you are cleaning up at night, if you come across any cockroaches, dead cockroaches, put them in a tissue box and bring them for me.
They must have thought you were quite strange.
Yes, and they didn't know.
In the UK, the campaign to free Anouche was picking up pace. Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe's husband, he's called Richard, had gone on hunger strike to protest, and he was supporting Anouche's family too. And then, after 5 years, the diplomatic talks succeeded. The UK paid its debt, and things were moving.
I was treating for lunch. I was treating two of my inmate friends. And we went and we had lunch. And as we finished our lunch, the people who were themselves prisoners, who sit at the entrance of the hall behind the microphone, they called me and they said, go and pack your stuff. Then I knew.
Anouche was taken to the airport by British officials. There he met Nazanin. She'd been allowed to leave the country too. They flew first to Oman, where they changed planes. Back in London, Anouche's family were already celebrating. This is his daughter, Alika, speaking to the BBC.
Exactly. And we're beyond happy and over the moon. We are going to expect him here tonight, like this evening. So, yeah, we're waiting with champagne and cake.
And what is the first thing you're going to do? What's the first thing you're going to say?
Oh, I don't know. We're definitely going to hug, and it would be very weird to see him in person. And we bought him his favorite beer, and I think it's going to be his first beer in nearly 5 years. So he's going to enjoy that very much.
Indeed, Anouche had been looking forward to his first drink. And in fact, he was getting a head start on the flight home.
There, well, I raised my first glass of champagne with Nazanin. And I think by the time we landed in Bryce Norton Airfield, I was quite tipsy, actually.
You were quite tipsy by that point. You had reason to be. Tell me about being reunited with Sherry. Tell me about that moment.
It was out of this world. I mean, we should invent new words for these sort of feelings and emotions. Holding her in my arms, holding Elika and Arian in my arms. I mean, even when we were taken to the safe house and we were there for a few days because reporters and a lot of people are actually camping outside our house, so they didn't want that. At the middle of the night, I woke up, I started touching Sherry's arm to see if this is real, because this had happened so many times inside of in prison that I felt that I dreamt that I was in Britain with my family, only to wake up to my what you used to call coffin, because the bunk that I was living in was at 1 meter by 2 meters. So I used to wake up to that with such a disappointment. But it was amazing.
Now you were back and you were next to Sherry. In the coming months, and as the time passed, I know you started working on that list of things that you'd wanted to achieve. Did you run the London Marathon?
The London Marathon happened in 2022, again with my kids, the three of us, in 2023, and then again in 2024. And we raised quite a bit of money for Hostage International and Amnesty International.
Amnesty International also helped Anouche fulfill another dream, to put on an exhibition. This happened for the first time earlier this year. It included a reconstruction of his cell and of Ashuri's corner. It also includes prison soundscapes and a lot of Anouche's artwork as well. He managed to smuggle out an impressive amount of material. He's still working on his memoir.
Have you allowed yourself, and have you been able to find a place now where you can just enjoy life And is there an anger about what you went through?
Never, ever during all my ordeal, I was angry in the sense that you're talking about. Disappointment, surely, about the inaction of the British government. If that money was paid long ago, Nazanin wouldn't have that fate, and I wouldn't.
The Foreign Secretary at the time, Liz Truss, was asked why it had taken so long to make progress in Anousheh's case. She said officials had been working tirelessly to make it happen. The Iranian government deny that payment for the tanks was relevant. They say Anousheh and Nazanin were released on humanitarian grounds. Of course, in this story, for you and for Sherry and for the people that love and care about you, it ends in a good place because you're here today and we can have this conversation and you can talk about these experiences. You can run the London Marathon, you can put on your exhibition. Are there people that you were held with who are still inside Evin prison?
Yes, unfortunately, and they are going through a lot of hell as we speak. But, I mean, there's so much agony going on in that country. So many artists. Anybody who has conscience, anybody who has empathy. I mean, this ideology, I don't know, this rotten way of thinking is destroying everything. It's a mixture of theocracy and kleptocracy together. See what sort of a concoction that will be. And this is what is going on in Iran at the moment.
That was Anousheh Ashoori speaking to me from our studio in London. Thanks for listening to Lives Less Ordinary. This episode was produced by Harry Graham and the editor was Andrea Kennedy. I'm Mubeen Azhar. Remember, normally, Lives Less Ordinary won't be in the documentary podcast. So if you'd like to hear more episodes, such as the story of the American woman who swam from Cuba to Florida after 30 years of trying, or the Jewish boy who escaped from the Nazis by hiding out in the woods, just search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hi, I'm Gideon Long, and on Business Daily, we're looking at shipwrecks. We'll dive into the dispute over the Spanish galleon, the San Jose, which sank off the coast of Colombia 300 years ago with billions of dollars worth of booty on board. And we asked businessman Carl Allen why he became a shipwreck hunter. Join us on Business Daily from the BBC World Service every weekday to hear more about the daily drama of money and work. Search for Business Daily wherever you get your BBC podcasts.